Now turning on the microphone, so we are live.
All right.
Okay, so this is Lori Barrow. Today is November 4th, 2016. I'm a research intern at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I am interviewing Gary Morishima. This interview is taking place at the 2006 SAF National Convention in Madison, Wisconsin at the Monona Terrace Convention Center. This interview is sponsored by the Society of American Foresters and the University of Wisconsin Oral History Program, and is part of the SAF Oral History Project. Now, Gary, can you say your name and spell your last name?
Okay, name is Gary Morishima, GaryMorishima.
Great, thanks. So to start off our conversation, can you tell me the story of how you became a forester?
Well, that's a fairly long story. I actually started at the University of Washington in architecture, and after working in an architect's office for a little while, I decided this wasn't something I wanted to do. So I was also working at the Boeing Airplane Company. And at the Boeing Airplane Company, and some of my personal interests as well, I was very interested in the environment and some of the things that were actually happening with respect to the narrow view of natural resource management and many of the problems that were being experienced. Some of this came about from Rachel Carlson's book, The Silent Spring. And what I concluded while I was at the Boeing Airplane Company was that these narrow disciplined kinds of programs weren't giving people the kind of information that they really needed to understand what was going on in natural resources and why they were in so much trouble. So I decided to go back to graduate school and went back to the University of Washington, entered into an individual PhD program on quantitative science and environmental management. And that's an interdisciplinary program involving statistics and economics and law and forestry and fisheries and a whole variety of things. What I found very quickly was that these stovepipes, academic stovepipes, if you will, served as impediments. And the people that were working on the same problems at different disciplines couldn't talk to one another, that they would use terms that meant different things to them, and that was leading to misunderstanding and bad decisions in the long run. So I went back to school and actually got involved in a number of graduate programs where we were doing some research on different topics. And I happened to be in a class that was in fisheries population dynamics. And the professor of that class was actually approached by some leaders of the Quinault Indian Nation. That's an Indian tribe in Washington State, and I still work with the Quinault Indian Nation. But the leadership of the tribe came to the University of Washington and asked for some help. So one of the things that happened was, as a result of that contact, is that we set up a program at the University of Washington and at the University of British Columbia. That the program actually involves volunteering time. Professors at the both universities volunteered a certain amount of their time and expertise in different areas to go out and assist the Quinault Nation. One of the things that the Quinault Nation wanted some assistance with was land management problems and forest management problems. That happened as a result of years of really domination by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. I don't know if you know very much about the Bureau of Indian Affairs, but that's an entity that was established just about the time of the Forest Service. So it's a little over 100 years old. And for well over 80 years, the Bureau of Indian Affairs was dominating all the decisions on land and forest management. And what happened at Quinault was that they entered into very large long-term timber contracts that resulted in clear cuts, 30,000 acre clear cuts, and it left enormous rehabilitation problems. Mm-hmm. So as part of that effort to provide assistance to the Quinault Nation, I went out to the to the reservation and viewed firsthand a number of the problems that they were encountering. And there were rather unique problems and things that I thought that I might be able to contribute to. After I got out of graduate school, the Quinault Nation asked me to go in and help them set up their own natural resource program. So I helped them set up both their fisheries and their forestry programs. The Quinault Nation, as a result of what's called the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act, that was passed in 1975. And at that time, as I mentioned, the Bureau of Indian Affairs was making all the decisions on behalf of the tribe and the landowners. The tribes didn't like what they were saying. They filed suit against the United States in the early 1970s. That suit resulted in a determination that the United States had a fiduciary trust responsibility for management of Indian forests. The suit ultimately ended up with the United States being found liable for mismanagement of the Quinault lands and timber. As a result of the Self-Determination Act, the Quinault Nation was in a position where it could go forward and make proposals as to how it wanted to manage certain services and functions of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So I helped set up, I think it was probably the first Indian Natural Resources Forestry Program. Mm-hmm. And we went back to Congress and got support from Congress for a 10-year pilot program to actually demonstrate the ability of tribes to take on the management of their own forest resources. So in a nutshell, that's how I first got involved. It's a fairly long and involved story, I know, but that's how my initial engagement in forest management actually started.
Mm-hmm. No, I appreciate you sharing that, and I think it sounds like a very rewarding experience to, mm-hmm. to work with the tribe. You touched on this a little bit, but could you tell me a little bit more about your career, perhaps, as a professional forestry after getting out of grad school?
Well, as I mentioned, I had the opportunity. It's something that really people fresh out of grad school and things very rarely have an opportunity to do, and that was basically to start something from scratch. Mm-hmm. That the Bureau of Indian Affairs forestry program, as it was focused primarily on timber production. So they had no provisions and no thought given as to what needed to be done to restore and maintain the health of the forest and the land. So we set up these programs from actually scratch. So we went out and did the inventory systems and developed systems to remove, it was actually an average of 200 tons of slash per mm-hmm. acre. So we had to develop some innovative programs to actually develop those. Mm-hmm. The inventory systems that we developed, we instituted stand-based management programs on the Quinault Reservation. We utilize satellite imagery, and I think we're one of the first entities actually to pursue that. We developed soils inventories that told us about the sensitivities of the land and what the land was capable of doing. Mm-hmm. We went out and hired forest economists. We had people that were skilled and experienced in terms of restoration work, restoration being things like you want to get the land in a position where you can clear it and take care of it. Mm-hmm. Much of that actually involved not only the technical aspects of it, it involved sort of the political aspects mm-hmm. as well. As you can imagine, the Quinault Nations are sort of being an upstart organization, an upstart entity, trying to get their feet on the ground in forest management, was up against an institution, you know, the United States government. And their entities had been in the position of making all the decisions for tribes for many, many years. So there was a lot of resistance, and many of the things that we felt needed to be done, we had the advice and the assistance of private industry, academia, and others who saw what was going on the Quinault Reservation. We brought a number of folks out to see firsthand what we were confronted with and asked for their advice and recommendations. But we found ourselves in a situation where we could not implement some of the things that we felt had to be done. For example, large-scale prescribed burning on the reservation. The Quinault Reservation is located in coastal rainforest in the Olympic Peninsula of Washington State. So we wanted to institute prescribed burning programs to help us open up some spots so we could begin to replant the next forest, and ran into a great deal of opposition from the Department of Interior. So we worked for a while to obtain a site visit by the Secretary of Interior. So we had the Secretary, we managed to convince the Secretary of Interior that he had to come out and see what was going on and make some changes. And as a result of Secretary Andrus came out to the reservation along with a local congressman and the various officials of the Department of Interior. And as a result of that, some major changes were made in terms of the authority that we were given to be able to institute land management practices that we thought were necessary. So we managed to start prescribed burning programs. We managed to develop programs that were geared toward long-term productivity. We invested in developing genetic improvement programs for the trees and species and characteristics that we were interested in promoting out there. We embarked upon site preparation work, a number of different aspects of things. So it basically started from the beginning there. One of the things that we also found during the early years of formation was that the Quinault Nation wasn't alone in terms of its relationships with the Bureau of Indian Affairs Forestry Program. And we saw and contrasted the kind of management that Indian lands were receiving compared to the lands of private industry, state, federal management, and all those kinds of things. And we started an organization, decided that we needed to start sharing ideas. So we convened something called the Indian Timber Symposiums. So it's a national Indian Timber Symposiums, where we brought people to a single location, number of tribes from around the country. We had private industry, we had academia, we had federal and state managers, all those things. So we came in and we shared ideas. And as a result of the very first symposium, there was a decision made of tribes to form an organization called the Intertribal Timber Council. And that was formed in 1976, so it's about the 42nd year in which we have been continually convening these symposiums.
That's great history. Thank you so much for sharing. I just want to clarify, were you working with the Quinault tribe then, or were you working with the university when you were in that position?
Well, I was working with started out working with the university and then went to set up the forestry program for the Quinault Nation.
Okay, thank you.
And that was shortly after the Indian Self-Determination Act went into place. Something else that I am still heavily involved in and was involved in at that time was to provide technical advice and assistance to the Quinault Nation and other tribes that were engaged in other litigation. This was the fishing rights litigation, United States versus Washington. So I got involved in a lot of issues besides just forestry. So I've been involved in forestry and fisheries management for a long time now.
I think this perhaps opens the door to the heart of what this conversation is going to, is the next set of questions we're interested in asking. And because you signed up for this, I think you might have an idea of what this oral history project is about. So for the purpose of this project, we're interested in exploring and trying to understand people's perception of diversity and inclusion in the forestry profession. And I was wondering if you could just speak to how your cultural or ethnic identity has shaped how you your career as a forester.
Well, I can try to answer that in a number of ways. One, my ethnic background is actually Japanese-American, and I was born in a concentration camp, actually, where the United States put Japanese-Americans in these camps during World War II. And as a result of that, as I grew up, I actually experienced a lot of reaction, negative reactions to, being of Japanese-American descent, and a lot of carryover from the wars. But that kind of experience, I think, gave me some understanding and familiarity of the kinds of challenges that Indian tribes were confronted with, being confined to reservations, for example, where they were dictated as to what could be done and what they could do, and the latitudes of the decision-making authorities that they had. So one of the things that I found in setting up the forestry program for the Quinault Nation was that the forestry profession was dominated by white males. Okay? And they weren't being challenged. There were sort of internal, basically philosophical debates, but they didn't really have any appreciation for the cultural differences behind attitudes towards land and natural resources. They didn't appreciate that to Indian people that the forest meant a heck of a lot more than the money that you could earn from cutting down the trees and converting them to lumber. So the multidimensional aspects of natural resource management and the various values that had to be reflected in terms of management from the tribal perspective clashed. So the lack of understanding, lack of recognition that there was more than one thing that should be sought from the management of our forests was a big issue that we had to contend with. So as I mentioned, I did get involved in a lot of fisheries issues. The environmental challenges that the Quinault Nation was facing were really enormous. So we were struck with very severe land ownership problems, and that came about from years of failed federal policies. The Quinault Reservation is roughly 200,000 acres of land that's primarily suited for forest production. In the late 1800s, the United States enacted some legislation called the General Allotment Act, 1887, is when that passed. But under that act, the United States was hell-bent on converting Indians into farmlands. So they divided up reservation lands into 80, 160, 320-acre parcels. On the Quinault Reservation, what started out as 200,000 acres of land ended up as 2,340 individually owned 80-acre allotments. And over time, what happened was those allotments, the ownership of those allotments changed as a result of the original allottees, original owners, passing on. And many of them did not leave wills or anything like that. So the property passed intestate. So what was started out as a single individual of an 80-acre parcel could have as many as 200, 400 individuals of undivided property ownership. And that created tremendous land ownership problems. Coupled with that, in the 1950s and early 1960s, the United States embarked upon a policy called termination, where they tried to absolve the federal government, get it, they wanted the federal government to get out of the Indian business. And one way of doing that was that they terminated lands with terminated reservations that had substantial forest resources. On Quinault, since all the land had been allotted, they couldn't do that very easily. So what they embarked upon was a supervised sale program. And under the supervised sale program, they ended up selling about a third of the reservation to large timber companies in the area. So if you can sort of imagine the kind of land ownership challenges and problems that that we were confronted with at the time, and the kind of land management practices that had been in place there for since the early 1900s, liquidation forestry, basically. And they left the land and its rivers and its salmon resources in devastated conditions. So we had to develop programs, we being myself and others that were working with the leadership of the Quinault Nation at the time. We developed these natural resource programs where we attempted to integrate the land and the fisheries and water management and cultural resource management, all those kinds of things together.
It's a lot to take in, but I'm wondering, as a Japanese American working with the Quinault at this time when there was some uncontested assumptions, mm-hmm. what was that like?
Well, it was both frustrating and invigorating. Frustrating because it kept on knocking heads. So I felt an affinity and a connection with the tribes and with the values and how they approached some of the issues that they were facing. And that was actually quite different than what you would encounter in terms of dealing with a federal bureaucracy and an entity. It was also somewhat frustrating in terms of a lot of the professionals that I came into contact, they didn't know anything about Indians. Mm. They didn't know anything about special relationships between the United States and Indians. They didn't understand anything about treaties. They didn't understand anything about trust relationships or fiduciary obligations of the United States. So there was a lot that had to be done in terms of educating mm-hmm. folks. The same for Congress. When you worked with Congress, getting them to approve the Quinault program. So there was a lot of frustration, but there were moments of exhilaration, things where we were able to initiate new programs, mm-hmm. initiate prescribed burning programs, initiate the large-scale land clearing programs and reforestation programs, sort of building that infrastructure from scratch. Mm-hmm. So there were times when there was a great deal of satisfaction, times when there was a lot of frustration as well. And this carried over, besides forestry and into fisheries management as well. With the decision in U.S. versus Washington, that was a similar situation in that the state of Washington had been accustomed to being in control and being essentially the sole entity that could be that was authorized to make decisions. And as a result of U.S. versus Washington, that changed. And what ended up happening is that a new resource manager came on the scene, and that was the tribes. Mm. So the tribes developed their own expertise mm-hmm. and developed the technical capabilities, actually, to begin to make some fundamental changes in the way that fisheries are managed in the state of Washington.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that your, what do you think about your own background and history allowed you to serve in that position or that role?
Well, as I mentioned, I think that I had a connection just because of where I was, who I am, and who I was born in, and the background and my perspectives that I gained over the years. I had also developed some pretty good working relationships with some pretty remarkable tribal leaders. Joe Dela Cruz, who was the served as the president of the Quinault Nation for many decades, was one of the tribal leaders that came to the University of Washington and requested some help. Mm-hmm. I developed a pretty strong relationship with Joe and managed to work with him on a number of federal initiatives besides just forestry and fisheries, the self-governance program, the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act. I worked with a fellow by the name of Guy McMines. Guy McMines was a student at the University of Washington. And he was a member of the Quinault Nation, and this was right around the time when there was a great deal of controversy over the Indian fishing rights cases, mm-hmm. the early 1970s. The case was decided in 1974. So I had relationships developed with him. I developed relationships with Billy Frank Jr. I don't know if you know Billy Frank Jr., but he's a very well recognized tribal activist that was involved in the fishing rights cases. So the ties to specific individuals that were passionate about what they needed to do, were visionaries in terms of what they wanted to do, and had the faith in me to say, this is what we want done. Mm-hmm. And can you help us?
What are your thoughts about the state of diversity and inclusion in the forestry profession now?
Well, they're trying, but it's difficult. I think that one of the challenges, again, is trying to make those connections. There are cultural differences. There are a lot of women that are beginning to get involved in terms of the forestry profession. Minorities are still lacking very substantially. And, you know, the tribal minorities, Asian minorities, Hispanics, African Americans, those kinds of representations are still lacking. They strive to include them. And once in a while, there's an opportunity arising. Butch Blazer, for example, is in a key position within the USDA. Mm-hmm. And he managed to increase the awareness and the value of including different perspectives. And that's essentially one of the major challenges that we have today in terms of forest management, is that there have to be a way in which you can develop the visions, the skills, the knowledges, the perspectives, and values of different people if you're going to find a way of getting out of the mess that we're presently in. And, you know, the single perspectives, one of the big challenges has been the lack of engagement and lack of involvement in many of the academic institutions representing other points of view. So you get into these forestry programs, forestry classes, and those sorts of things. They're pretty rote, and they're pretty stale from my perspective, and that they don't really present alternative viewpoints in a way that they can be evaluated and understood so that people can get a better appreciation of what they may be able to contribute to the solution of some of the environmental and, you know, forestry problems that we're facing today.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that that is influencing the lack of minority representation?
Well, I think that one of the challenges is the connections of people in the environment. And that's, I think, a place where there's really an opportunity, particularly with Native American communities, because they're tied to the land. Mm-hmm. Their psyche, their whole being, their cultures and identity is tied to the land. And that's something that you don't see in the general populace. You know, the African Americans, for example, or Asian Americans, those kinds of things. They don't have that connection to place, they're permanent in place. That they're pretty mobile and have other opportunities and things that they may wish to pursue. Mm-hmm. So it's really about finding that sort of personal connection to the land and place and the people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think your own cultural identity has helped you in your job as a forester?
Certainly, yeah. As I mentioned, it recognize that, you know, as I hate to use the term, but basically minorities, that you're in a certain position where sometimes your views and perspectives and things may not be valued as highly as, you know, someone else that has a different background or different perspectives, and that makes it challenging at many times. Mm-hmm. But being put in that position, it also creates a situation where you recognize that you're a potential instrument of change, because change is going to have to come from outside. It's going to have to come from a different direction. If you've got something that's really firmly established and everybody's used to doing the same old thing over and over again, that the opportunities for innovation and bringing in other values and other perspectives into the management arena becomes, you know, challenging. That's where, you know, some of the background that I've experienced might be of some value in terms of finding the position that you're in within the ability to actually effect change, to implement and influence change.
Where do you see the profession of forestry going in the next 20 to 50 years?
20 to 50 years.
Or 5 years.
Well, I see it actually changing substantially, you know, particularly with respect to public lands. The public land management, one of the difficulties has been is that you try to make the public lands all things for all people. And as a result, the ability to actually manage the land is being lost. So if you look at things like wildfire right now, well, you've got huge wildfires, many of which originated on federal lands. Forest Service budget, over half the budget now is being consumed by wildfires. And if you look at the projections for that, that's going to continue, right? And what does that mean? That means that nobody's going to be taking care of the land unless something fundamentally changes. And I think that what will have to change within the near future is that people will need to understand that the forest is more than just a bunch of trees, it's more than just you know, bowls being waited to be converted into lumber to build somebody's houses or do other things. That the forest is valued for many things and has many potentials to contribute to the welfare and benefit of society as a whole. So that has to change. There needs to be a recognition that our forests are worth, you know, they're a lot more than just a bunch of trees. They take care of the water, they care, they provide jobs, they provide recreational opportunities, all those things. But the system that we operate within right now doesn't really value those in a way that not only the Forest Service, but private landowners and others who need to have their forests on the land in order to preserve those values and the functions that are necessary, they have to be able to benefit from that. So it'll get more and more away from things like timber production. It will get into the development of much kinds of different materials and opportunities, biorefining, nanocellulose production, those kinds of things are going to open up new avenues for the utilization of the products in the forest. Some ability to benefit from recreational opportunities, minor forest products. Those kinds of things are going to become much more important to the management of the forest than timber production. Water is going to be a key.
Very important.
Yeah.
And often underrated. Do you have a specific moment or event that changed or impacted the way you viewed forestry?
A specific moment? I think probably the moment was when I first visited the Quinault Reservation. As you know, I've been familiar with federal land management, state management, but when I went out to the Quinault Reservation and saw the challenges that they were facing, it was a shock. Because I could see the consequences of the failure to provide for the future. And I was in a position to be able to do something about it.
That must have been a good feeling.
Yeah.
To know you could help. What advice would you give to newly minted foresters going into the field right now?
Well, keep your eyes open and don't be careful to challenge. Don't be hesitant to challenge. Look for the values that that other people may have and the perspectives and viewpoints, and to try to find a way of helping not only them achieve their visions for what it is that they wish to achieve, but help them recognize that they're part of a bigger challenge, right? Mm-hmm. A bigger mission. And if you can get that kind of commitment, that goal or objective, I think that that will go an awful long way. Because many people, I think that they come out against stovepiped. They say, well, I know everything there is to know about this. But then when they find out, they try to apply that in practice, they find out that somebody sitting next to them has a different idea, a different perspective. Mm-hmm. That has to be, acknowledged and addressed as well.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not in this alone. And they can't do it alone, but they can be a part of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know I'll certainly take that to heart.
Yeah.
Moving forward. Because we are at the conference for the Society of American Foresters, one, how have you been involved with the Society of American Foresters, and what role do you think SAF has in promoting and encouraging diversity or inclusion?
Well, I participated in a few symposiums, given presentations and written articles for the Journal of Forestry and that sort of thing before. At this particular meeting, I'm here to present a paper that I'm working on with a colleague on our nation's forest needs, America's first stewards. And that gets a little bit into the history of forestry and how we got in the predicament we're in and the potential for tribes to help show the way, mm-hmm. at least a way, to the future. In terms of involving the future engagement of the Society of American Foresters. The Society of American Foresters, I think, is an organization that is quite diverse. In terms of the kinds of disciplines and kinds of experiences that people can bring mm-hmm. to the table, it can set up a unique mentorship program and those kinds of things if there's a desire to do so. I'm going to be participating, I think it's called Policy and Popcorn Session tomorrow, mm-hmm. In which it's really targeted at natives, but I think that it needs to be broadened. And it needs to be broadened beyond just the profession. So one of the problems that we have in terms of the future of forests and future of forestry is that we've been paying way too much attention to professional credentials.
Mm-hmm.
And that what we need to do is to make sure that we have people, the boots on the ground, with the skills and the practical know-how and experience to actually get the job done that needs to be done in the field. So instead of doing all these simulation studies or gathering data and those sorts of stuff, somebody has to do something on the ground to care for the land and to care for the resources that provide the services and the goods that we really wanted to have. So we need to broaden it from just the professional credentials of, the certified foresters or professional foresters or those sorts of things, and pay attention to those folks that are out there marking trees or administering timber sales. There's a lot of technicians and things that their skills are disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
There are people without the capacity to actually run the equipment or take care of the equipment that's necessary to be able to treat the land or run the mills, those kinds of things. Those skills are disappearing, and nobody seems to be paying a heck of a lot of attention to it. But you can't take care of the forest from your office. You've got to have the whole ball of wax. You've got to have all the pieces in order for you to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I think that somebody really needs to give some thought as to what we can do to promote all the pieces to the puzzle so that they will be in place and capable of taking care of the land.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's one of the biggest challenges we face as a profession moving forward?
Well, one of the biggest challenges is communication. That a great many people in the general public don't understand forestry. They hear the word forestry, they think that you're out there with an axe or a chainsaw. Mm-hmm. And they basically equate it with logging. And they don't understand that professional foresters and the various skills that come with the forestry profession give you a responsibility to do a whole lot more and the capability of doing a whole lot more. So communication is a big problem, is a huge gap, mm-hmm. in terms of why do we need to care for the land? How do you respect the land? How do you respect the forest? You don't do that by neglecting it. You have to care for it. And that means really active management. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think we've touched on this too, but for the sake of asking, what has been the biggest challenge of your career?
Well, I think the greatest challenge has really been being able to find people that can maintain sort of continuity. Mm. That, you know, I might have a vision or capability of doing certain things, but there are very few people behind me.
Can you explain that a little bit more?
Well, it takes a certain amount of experience, I guess, mm-hmm. in terms of being confronted with particular challenges and given some opportunities and giving the willingness actually to dedicate the time and energy to understand what it is you're looking at and have a vision that, you know, this is what I think needs to happen in the future, and be able to convince others who are in positions of authority and responsibility to share that vision. So the challenges are there are very few professionals there. The leadership is constantly changing. So political or administrative leadership, those things are, you know, long-term to then is basically the next election cycle. Mm-hmm. And with forestry, you're looking at things that are going to take decades, sometimes centuries, to actually take effect. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. For the sake of time, and
sure,
would you like to add anything regarding forestry or the Society of American Foresters of Diversity that we perhaps didn't touch on or didn't cover?
No, but I think that some of the old school ways of making sure, for example, that you have accreditation programs, accreditation systems, that really doesn't get to the problems that we're facing, as I was talking about earlier. The need to understand that it takes more than just people with a little sheepskin on the wall, mm-hmm. to manage a forest. Mm-hmm. And tribal community colleges is a good example of that. You know, it's very difficult for tribal community colleges to be able to be accredited, you know, as junior forestry people, because they may not have, they may have certainly all the skills in the programs, but they don't have numbers of people. Mm-hmm. They don't meet in certain kinds of guidelines that have been established for whatever reason, mm-hmm. but they don't work. Mm.
That's really interesting. Yeah. Do you think additional resources or the support, more support from SAF or the forestry professional, like the U.S. Forest Service, might help in that?
Well, I did think it could, but as I mentioned, one of the difficulties you run into with an agency, you know, particularly the size of the Forest Service, mm-hmm. and those sorts of things, whose mission is changing substantially, is continuity. Mm-hmm. That these aren't things that you can throw money at and, you know, 5 years you've got the answer. Mm-hmm. It'll take a long-term commitment, mm-hmm. and it'll take some careful thought as to how you can actually achieve your objectives. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, maybe, you know, I hate to even suggest this, but a committee of some sort diversity of, you know, the workforce diversity. One of the challenges you have is people are competing against one another. So the Forest Service has a problem with diversity, so do the state agencies, so does private industry, all these folks. And there are very few people out there. So what you end up doing is you can create a program to develop a well-skilled professional here, but somebody says, oh, geez, there's somebody that can help me, and pretty soon that individual goes someplace else. Mm-hmm. And you end up either serving as a training ground. This is something that's happening a lot within tribal communities and tribal resource programs now, that the ability to gain the skills and the expertise that's necessary to care for the land, a lot of it's being developed in the tribal resource programs. There are 557 federally recognized tribes. There are 336 of those tribes that have significant forest resources. Many of those tribes with significant natural resources, forestry professions, those kinds of things, they're serving as entry points for people getting out of school and that sort of thing, so that they can gain some skills and knowledge. But once that happens, there's that, you know, plucking the ripe fruit syndrome that's out there. Mm-hmm. So it's not something that you can approach sort of agency by agency. It's one that's systemic, and you've got to recognize that there are interactions between what you do here and what somebody else is doing over here. And then unless you see the whole picture, mm-hmm. then you're not going to get with where you want to go, or you may end up in a place you don't want to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think the students are leaving, the students that were trained are leaving, why do you think they're leaving?
Pardon me?
Why the students are being plucked away from who are trained on a...
Well, I know a number of reasons why. I mean, within tribal communities, tribal resource programs are being underfunded substantially. Mm. Tribal forestry, for example, gets on a per acre basis about 30% of what the Forest Service receives per acre. And the levels that tribes are able to pay for their skills is pretty low. It's low compared to the industry or what they can get from others, particularly mm-hmm. if those folks are trying to meet equal opportunity or, you know, those kinds of diversity objectives, whatever you want to call them, that those people have a premium, right? Mm-hmm. They can command a premium to move from one place to another. Mm-hmm. And the people that do stay develop that connection with particular tribe, with particular communities, with particular jobs that they are being asked to do. They find that personally satisfying. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense.
So there's actually, if you're interested in that, you can look at there's the Indian Forest Management Assessment Team reports. I haven't talked about those, but the third report came out in 2013, mm-hmm. and that has a section in it on workforce, and will give you an idea of the kinds of issues and challenges that we're facing in Indian country in terms of the number of professionals that are involved, how old they are, mm-hmm. And some of the challenges that they face in terms of being able to bring new people mm-hmm. into the programs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll definitely take a look at that. And I really appreciate you taking the time today. I have one follow-up question just so that we are able to keep everything together. To finish up, we have a few demographic questions. We ask that you state what year you were born, what gender you identify as, and what your racial or ethnic background is.
Okay, 1944. Gender male. And then you asked about ethnic background, mm-hmm. Japanese American. So,
all right, I will now turn off the recording.
Okay.